From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, considering new sanctions against Russia. A UN official says the fight against terrorism must not violate human rights. The disappearance of journalist Austin Tice in Syria.
We know that he's not held by ISIS. We know that he's not held by any terrorist group. We know that there has been no ransom or concession request.
And African Americans recall the 1960s fight for voting rights. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. A top U.S. official says Washington could impose new sanctions on Russia if a month-old Ukraine ceasefire reached in Minsk continues to be violated. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, told U.S. lawmakers Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin's government continues to fuel the fire of violent separatism in eastern Ukraine.
The United States and the EU have worked in lockstep to impose successive rounds of tough sanctions, including deep sectoral sanctions on Russia and its separatist cronies as the cost for these actions. And those sanctions are biting deeply on the Russian economy. The Minsk package of agreements, September 5th, September 19th, and the February 12th implementing agreement offer the promise of peace, disarmament, political normalization and decentralization in eastern Ukraine, and along with them, the return of Ukraine's state sovereignty and border control in the east. As we have long said, the United States will start to roll back sanctions on Russia when the Minsk agreements are fully implemented, and so will our European partners. But as the President has also said, we will judge Russia by its actions, not its words. And we have already begun this week intensive consultations with our European partners on further sanctions pressure should Russia continue fueling the fire in the east of Ukraine or in other parts of the country, fail to implement Minsk, or grab more land, as we saw in Debaltseve.
The commander of U.S. Army Europe, Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, says 12,000 Russian troops are supporting the separatists in eastern Ukraine, while 29,000 Russian troops are stationed in Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula Russia annexed from Ukraine last year. Russia analyst Jonathan Adelman of the University of Denver tells VOA's Victor Beatty, the problem is Russia is convinced the West is not serious about confronting Moscow over its Ukraine policy.
They look what's happening in the Iranian nuclear negotiations, where from the Russian point of view, Americans keep making concession after concession. They look at the weakness of the European Union. So until they become convinced that they've reached the end of the line and that we're really going to do something for the Ukrainians, and I don't mean the kind of level at which we're at right now, and the fact that they have almost $400 billion in reserve from the heady days when oil was well over $100 a barrel, and that they're winning. And so that, I think, is the core problem. They just don't believe that the United States and the Europeans are going to get serious about doing something. And meanwhile, this is really reinforcing Vladimir Putin's popularity at home. He's at 84%. So he's saying, I think I'll take a little bit more risk here. And that's what he's been doing because he doesn't see it as particularly risky. And it's a sad thing.
What alterations in U.S. policy do you think are warranted at this time?
The problem is the only thing that would really work against Vladimir Putin, because after all, the Germans have extensive trade with him, the Greeks have made good relationship with him, and so forth. I think it would be the threat that we actually would significantly beef up our NATO presence and consider that Ukraine, which is not a member of NATO, at least have some kind of credible threat, because the Russians are winning. And they're going to continue to win, and this bolsters Vladimir Putin. And remember, he's facing serious problems. The ruble is down 50%, price of oil is down 50%, there's demonstrations at home. He is doing this as an offset. This is really buttressing his position. So I think we'd have to have some much more credible notions of either serious support for the Ukrainians, but they also need to be trained, or our European allies to get much more serious, because thus far, we like them, and they're really doing good things in other areas, but this is not an area that they're used to. They're used to the United States taking the lead.
Meanwhile, Russian opposition activists say they will publish documents gathered by opposition leader Boris Nemtsov before his February 27th murder that purport to show Russia's direct military role in Ukraine. Leslie Templeman-Holmes, another Russia analyst at the University of Melbourne in Australia, believes the opposition's documentation may be very damaging politically to President Putin.
He has so far been a so-called Teflon president. We've used that term in other contexts, for instance, with President Reagan. But Putin has been particularly capable of dealing with any opposition. However, his country is in problems now, part because of the sanctions, partly because of the marked decrease in the price of oil. He's got serious economic problems, a 50% decline in the exchange value of the ruble, for instance. That, added to what's likely to be damning evidence, is going to start a whole new ballgame, in my opinion. That I wouldn't put it past him that he can survive, but he's going to be in more trouble now in the next few days, in my opinion, than he's been for years.
That's going contrary to what other analysts seem to be indicating, that he's at 84% popularity. Why the sudden turnaround, in your view?
If it's proven that there really are Russian troops, contrary to what he and his foreign minister, Lavrov, have been saying all the time, he comes across as a complete liar. Now, of course, there will be a number of Russians who say, well, that's fair enough. Ukraine should be, always has been, closely linked with Russia. Of course, they were together in the USSR and the Soviet Union. But there will be a number of other Russians who will feel, well, he's been lying to us all this time. So far, he's been given the benefit of the doubt by most Russians, because they wanted to believe him, because they wanted to believe that Russia is a great power again.
So, ironically, Mr. Nemtsov's murder may actually turn against Mr. Putin.
In my opinion, it already is. Putin is very worried that the kinds of revelations that are going to come forward are not only about Russian soldiers' involvement in eastern Ukraine, but also a lot of hard evidence about corruption. Alexander Navalny, who's probably the best known of all the Russian anti-corruption activists, said that these will be damning and very concrete pieces of evidence against the regime, not just Putin himself, but others as well. And let's not forget that this is one of the major factors that brought down Yanukovych in Ukraine a little over a year ago.
Ohm says if he could advise the West, he would counsel patience until the opposition documentation is released and the official Russian investigation into Nemtsov's murder is released. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Saudi Arabia to ease concerns among Gulf states about the potential impact of a possible nuclear deal with Iran. Kerry is trying to assure members of the Gulf Cooperation Council that the bargain being negotiated in Montreux, Switzerland, would not enable Iran to become a regional superpower. Kerry's visit comes days after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the U.S. Congress that the agreement would be a bad deal. A public opinion survey done by the University of Maryland last month, however, suggests that nearly two-thirds of Americans favor an agreement that would allow Iran to have limited enrichment as long as the agreement provides for thorough inspections. VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Shibli Talhami, who conducted the survey, about the potential regional and international impact of the proposed deal.
We basically looked at arguments for and against, the type of arguments that we hear in the public debates and in Congress, and the type of arguments also that the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, presented in Congress. So we test whether the American public would like to continue sanctions, would like to make a deal, what are the risks for each. And what is interesting is that the public in general is obviously ambivalent. They realize that there is no good option pertaining to Iran. So you have people who accept the argument that allowing Iran to have some enrichment has risks associated with it, a large majority, in fact. But you also have a lot of people who think that sanctions are not likely to work. You know, when you then ask them, okay, now you have to make a decision, what would you recommend to your policymakers? Make a deal that limits Iran's enrichment capability but allows them to reach at a level sufficient to produce nuclear energy with inspections, or reject that and maintain the sanctions or even increase them. And we have 61% of the American public say the U.S. Should take a deal like that, that they support a deal like that. And that seems to hold across party lines. Over 60% of both Democrats and Republicans support such a deal, and 54% of independents. So there is robust support, and the interesting thing is that this support has held for several months, despite the fact that people understand that this is not an easy question, that there are no perfect solutions.
President Obama said that Prime Minister Netanyahu did not offer in his speech to Congress an alternative approach to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. What are the other alternatives?
Clearly, when you look at the possibilities, if you don't agree to some kind of a deal, obviously as good as you can get, that allows Iran some enrichment and a lot of inspections that would help, safeguard against Iran developing nuclear weapons. The only alternative is having the sanctions in place and maybe even tightening them. And one can argue that sanctions have had an impact. There's no question about that. I don't think anybody would say that sanctions have not hurt Iran. The only question is whether they have really curtailed Iran's nuclear program. And I think there's a pretty much conventional wisdom that they have not much curtailed their nuclear programs, even if they have brought them back to the negotiating table. And so ultimately, certainly the American public seems to agree with the president that sanctions are not likely to prevent Iran from having nuclear weapons. And when you add to that the sense that the international coalition that is now in place with the sanctions imposed not only by the U.S., but by U.N. resolutions and enforced by, America's partners. Remember, the negotiations are not simply between the United States and Iran. They are between the five permanent members of the Security Council and Germany and Iran. And that coalition is really important for maintaining effectiveness in dealing with Iran. There's a sense that if the U.S. rejects a reasonable deal, then I don't think the international sanctions will stay in place. Maybe the American sanctions could, but that's not going to be effective vis-a-vis Iran, particularly since others are going to move to exploit it. So sanctions really aren't necessarily effective, and that's certainly where the public sentiment is. The final alternative is military action. Now, I don't think that anyone really wants to engage in a major military operation in the international community, and I think that's certainly true when it comes to American public opinion. Right now, one of the things that obviously is making the public more receptive to a deal, even one that is not perfect, is the fact that the public doesn't really want to get engaged in a war with Iran. They understand that Iran is a big country, geographically vast, with a lot of resources, and they've just obviously been tired of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think bottom line is, while people are weary and they don't really trust Iran per se, and they know that this deal isn't going to be perfect, when they weigh all the bad options, the American public really falls ultimately on the side of the Obama administration, meaning they want it to try to get the best deal it can get, and it's better than the rest of the alternatives.
Shibli Talhami with the University of Maryland. Friday, we plan on bringing you more of his insights. United Nations top human rights official warns the fight against terror must not be used as an excuse to undermine democracy and human rights. In a major speech to the 47-member UN Human Rights Council, Ziad Raad Al Hussein said efforts by states to combat terrorism are resulting in large-scale rights violations against the very citizens they claim to defend. Lisa Schlein reports from the council in Geneva.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Ziad Raad Al Hussein, warns that an overreaction to extremist violence threatens to erode the system for global security, which states built 70 years ago to ward off the horror of war. He says counter-terrorist operations that are disproportionate and brutal violate democratic norms and risk handing the terrorists a propaganda tool. In his speech, the High Commissioner cites a range of violations committed by terrorist groups, notably the Islamic State known as ISIS or ISIL, and the Nigerian Boko Haram militants. He describes acts of murder, torture, and other extreme acts of cruelty committed against women and children, genocidal attacks on ethnic as well as religious groups, and the destruction of cultural heritage. As repugnant as these acts are, the High Commissioner notes any response to extremist violence must be targeted, proportionate, and legal to be truly effective.
Military campaigns, financial sanctions, and attempts to staunch the inflow of weapons, such as the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty, may be part of the solution. But other actions are needed to stem the root causes that feed into these conflicts. We must acknowledge that large numbers of people do not join such extremist movements en masse because they have been suddenly and inexplicably hypnotized.
Zaid says extremism is nurtured by ideology. He also says people who are alienated by years of state tyranny, repression, discrimination, and deprivation are vulnerable to the lure of propaganda messages from extremist groups such as ISIL, which promise them an alternative as well as a better and more meaningful life.
Many of the recruits that flock to ISIL from well over 50 countries are drawn, I believe, by messages of persecution and pity. Filled with an ill-defined rage at what they perceive as unfair treatment in their own context, they may genuinely feel they are signing up to protect the abused. The fact that a vast majority of ISIL's victims are fellow Muslims receives far less publicity. A real campaign of ideas to discredit ISIL will need to mobilize such facts.
In his wide-ranging speech, the High Commissioner notes deep-seated concerns about restrictions of freedom of expression and the shrinking of democratic space in several countries. These include Armenia, Bangladesh, Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Egypt, Hungary, Russia, and Venezuela. He also expresses regret at the continued extensive use of the death penalty around the world and highlights serious cases of human rights abuses in countries such as the Central African Republic, North Korea, Mexico, Sudan, and South Sudan. These and numerous other issues will be debated and explored during the course of the current session of the Human Rights Council, which continues until the end of the month. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Reporters Without Borders is conducting a Free Austin Tice campaign to secure the release of the journalist missing in Syria. Delvin Algo is spearheading the operation, and we asked her, who is Austin Tice?
Austin Tice is an American freelance journalist who was working and reporting in Syria for McClatchy, Washington Post, among other media. When he disappeared in Syria near Damascus in August 2012.
Do we know where he is or who has him?
No, there is quite a level of uncertainty about his kidnapping, but we know who is not holding him. We know that he's not held by ISIS. We know that he's not held by any terrorist group. We know that there has been no ransom or concession request. And according to many diverse and credible sources, he is alive and treated pretty well.
How does your campaign work? What do people do?
So Austin Tice parents asked Reporters Without Borders help to launch a public awareness campaign to raise awareness about the unanswered kidnapping of Austin and to do everything possible to bring it back home. So we invite all American media to partner in the campaign to help us to and offer us banners on their media support, but also we invite any citizen to take part in the campaign by signing the Free Austin Tice petition, but also to take the blindfold pledge. The blindfold is a symbol of Austin unanswered kidnapping, but also the symbol that when a journalist is missing, we are deprived of information. We are ourselves blindfolded. So that's this campaign was just launched, and we continue to run until Austin's safe return.
Now, can people go to your website and sign up for this petition?
Yes, the website is freeaustintice@rsf.org.
And how has it been going so far?
We had an amazing support from the media. the Washington Post, Gannett, USA Today, the Atlantic Media Group, the McClatchy newspaper have been partners of the campaign, which means they gave us millions of digital impressions for digital ads on their website. The New York Times and the Washington Post offered us a full-page ad in the print newspaper. So it's really the first time that we observe such a mobilization of the American media to raise awareness about the missing American journalist.
Now, Syria is a very bad, difficult place for journalists.
Yes, indeed. Syria has been the most dangerous country for journalists since the start of the conflict in 2011. And it's really important to highlight that most of the journalists killed, arrested, detained, or kidnapped are Syrian journalists. And the Western journalists, maybe we pay a lot of attention when something happens to them, but we don't have to forget that the Syrian journalists have paid the highest price in this fight for freedom of information.
Delphine Algo, U.S. Director for Reporters Without Borders. U.S. President Barack Obama and thousands of people will gather in the small southern U.S. city of Selma, Alabama, Saturday to commemorate the 50th anniversary of a historic voting rights march that became known as Bloody Sunday. For VOA Television, Chris Simpkins reports.
Hundreds of peaceful African-American demonstrators marched for voting rights in Selma, Alabama, 50 years ago.
As the civil rights demonstrators made their way across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, they were met on the other side by a group of state police officers who attacked them.
The violent images outraged the nation, drawing national attention to the denial of voting rights for millions of African Americans.
I had to go to the courthouse, stand in line, and vote.
50 years later, civil rights activist Nims Gay returned to the Birmingham courthouse where he and other blacks questioned white county officials who rejected their constitutional right to vote.
What you're really trying to do is intimidate these people, and by making them stand in the raid, keep them from registering to vote.
Why do you think you're superior to me? Don't you realize with one blood all nations flow? Or is that something you don't understand? And see, that irritates them. But see, don't worry about nobody, irritate nobody. When you're right, you're right, and when you're wrong, you're wrong.
Following legal challenges, blacks were allowed to vote. He says the fight was hard but worth it.
A voteless people is a hopeless people. Don't care whether you're black, white, green, or gray. If you can't vote, you're messing up.
Retired teacher Gene Smiley was among the first blacks allowed to vote in Montgomery, Alabama.
A lot of people around in Montgomery and surrounding areas, so many of them were really afraid to go and try to vote.
If you had a job, just trying to register was enough to get you fired. And in addition to that, they would even fire some of your relatives.
Days after Bloody Sunday, Hank Sanders marched with Martin Luther King and thousands to Alabama's capital, Montgomery.
The power of the vote seemed so powerful to those who had it that they didn't want anybody else to have it. And they were doing everything they could. They were using every mechanism at their disposal to stop them.
The accomplishments that we made didn't occur by themselves.
Civil rights lawyer Fred Gray, who represented King, won a court ruling to allow the successful march from Selma to Montgomery.
It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life.
Gray says less than 5 months later, President Lyndon Johnson signed the 1965 Voting Rights Act into law. Back in Birmingham, Nims Gay sings the civil rights anthem that inspired him and so many others in this struggle for equality.
The Lord is on our side today. Deep in my heart.
Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Birmingham, Alabama.
We shall overcome someday.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.